All right, fantastic. I will go ahead and call the meeting of the Caltrain Work Program Legislative and Planning Committee to order. And first up, we have the Pledge of Allegiance. I don't know where the flag is exactly as opposed to how we appear in there, but I'm just going to propose that we all stand up and cover our hearts. And Director Chavez, why don't you lead us?
Thank you. I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty
and justice
for all.
All right. Thank you, Director Chavez. And next up, we have roll call.
Yes. Director Chavez?
Here.
Director Zamuda?
Here.
Chair Stone?
Present.
You have a quorum. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Item three is public comment on items not on the agenda. Comments at this point will be taken only insofar as they don't relate to any item that's agendized, and they will be limited to 3 minutes each. If there are items raised that we cannot respond to because of the Brown Act, they will be deferred to staff for them to reply. Do we have any public comment requests?
There are no public comments at this time.
Okay, moving on to item number four, which is the approval of the meeting minutes of February 26, 2020.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
Director Chavez?
Madam Clerk, would you take
roll? Aye.
Director Chavez?
Yes.
Director Zamuda?
Aye.
Chair Stone?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to item five, which is the Caltrain Business Plan Update covering March 2020. Welcome, Mr. Petty.
Hey, hi. Good to see you all. And can all of you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so let me see if I can guinea pig this. Okay. Are we seeing a PowerPoint?
It's trying.
I think it takes a minute
because,
from our prior
because
experience.
Because it's so long. Yeah, there it is.
Yep, perfect.
All right. So afternoon, I appreciate you all being able to do this under somewhat unusual circumstances. As Director Zamuda mentioned, this is a lengthy PowerPoint, and so I'm going to try to talk more about what is in the PowerPoint rather than going through every single slide. This is an update to the ongoing business plan process. We are reaching the true end of that process, but there are a few more pieces of technical analysis that we're undertaking here. I apologize. This is not the correct deck. Please bear with me. Sorry, bear with me for a moment, folks.
Okay. While Sebastian is doing that, this is germane to the business plan. I'll do a brief commentary as he's working on the deck. This is what I'm about to report out on is germane to the business plan in the sense that this is a financial support that we need to proceed to sustain and enhance our services if we're going to have the hope of implementing the business plan. As you probably know in following the news, there is a package that is, if not yet, soon to be approved by the federal government that is intended to be the response to the coronavirus. There's $25 billion in the package dedicated towards public transit across the country. Our calculation is for the San Francisco Bay Area, the funds could approach about $1.3 billion of that $25 billion package. I believe it is not formally passed or signed yet, but once that happens, there will be discussions in connection with how the funds will be received and distributed, and we are an active part of that process. So I just wanted to let you know.
That's great. Good.
Sebastian, you got the right deck now?
I believe so. And again, I apologize to everyone. And if for some reason there's a mismatch between what's in the public pack, we'll get that resolved. And sorry, it's a little bit of a new world with all of this. So as I mentioned, this still is a long deck, but it's really covering some of the pieces of technical work that we'll be completing as part of the business plan process. And so there are a couple items we wanted to provide this committee with an update on. The first relates to station access and connectivity. So we did not include that analysis in the original work we did as we were building up the service vision, and we want to provide an update on some of the analysis we've been doing related to how people get to and from Caltrain and how that may change in the future. And then the other subject, which I think is of interest to the board and members of the committee, is some work we're doing around an equity analysis. So understanding where Caltrain may have challenges today and what some of the options are to improve equity outcomes in the future as we move forward with the business plan process. I'll go quickly through these next slides. They just present the overall process of the business plan. And we really are at the end of the process now that the board has adopted the long-range service vision. We're filling through the last pieces of analysis and then are proceeding with just documenting the entire process for the board's adoption. So today there really are three pieces left in the rounding out the vision component of work: the analysis of connectivity and station access, the equity analysis, and then an analysis of funding opportunities. So really looking big picture at funding, not just in the next few years. That last piece is coming next month. So the first components of this deck talk about access to the Caltrain system. And kind of the global point that's important to remember as we think about access and think about the next 20 years for Caltrain is that if we're successful in tripling our ridership, it's really going to dramatically change our station. It's going to dramatically change how people get to Caltrain. And that's going to be an important part of achieving that tripling of ridership growth, is making sure that we have the kinds of connections to the regional transportation network and the kinds of station access and egress opportunities that our customers will find convenient and seamless and will help them actually take advantage of the system we hope to build. The next few slides, I won't go into a lot of detail, but they really kind of cover how people get to and from Caltrain today and what Caltrain's role in providing that connectivity and access is. I think an important point to understand in regard to Caltrain today is that Caltrain's role in providing first and last mile access today is limited, and it's somewhat varied depending on the mode. So we fund some shuttles. That's part of our role. We do provide and manage parking at many of our stations, and we do provide some bike facilities, including a very robust bike on board program. But that's roughly the sort of the domain of our access activities today. A lot of first last mile access is provided by our partner transit agencies or by local jurisdictions. I'll also spend some time on this slide, which really shows data from nearly the last 15 years. This is taken every 3 years from our triennial survey data where it's showing sort of our ridership growth overall. So this is in absolute numbers. And then the mode of access that those riders are using to get to the system. And so what you can see is that right now there's really a plurality of ways that people get to and from Caltrain. It's not an auto-dominated system by any means. The majority of our riders are getting to the system by walking. There's a healthy percentage who are driving, a healthy percentage who are taking bikes. We've got transit, drop-off, shuttles as other important modes. Also interesting to look at how those numbers have changed over time, where really a lot of the growth in ridership that Caltrain has experienced has been from people walking to the system. So when we think about how Caltrain has grown since 2007, a lot of that growth has happened on foot. Another sort of just interesting global slide to think about is station access by mode of income. And I'll talk about this a bit in the equity section. But in general, there are differences in terms of how people of different incomes access the system. One of the things we see is that folks of lower income are using transit to get to and from Caltrain at a higher rate, as opposed to folks in the higher income brackets are more likely to be park and riders or using bikes. The next several slides I won't talk through in detail, but they really just talk about each of these modes of access and kind of provide an overview of how those modes are used and managed today. So information about how Caltrain's parking system works today. We do have quite a few parking spaces in the system. They're a non-trivial source of income for the system, and varies significantly by stations. We've got some parking lots that are really full and some that are pretty empty. We charge a pretty reasonable for parking, but there is evidence that we're still below where the market is from a public standpoint. And so, you know, even just looking at the next few years, there are some things for us to think about in terms of how we manage our parking and whether we want to go to more of an active parking management where we're charging different rates at different stations, similar to the program that BART has in place. On transit, there are about 10% of our riders are coming to and from Caltrain from another transit system. A lot of those are in San Francisco with Muni connections. BTA, BART, Samtrans, and others all play an important role. One of the major challenges that Caltrain has with transit connectivity today is that we run a very unique schedule by train. And so trains are not arriving and departing at even intervals from stations today, and that makes it very challenging to have coordinated seamless connections with other transit systems. And that's something we view as a major opportunity for change once we move to an electrified service. Additionally, some challenges around having different fare structures and programs in place among operators that create different transfer rules for folks. And so definitely something to look at here as we move forward. And we'll talk about this as well when we get to the equity section. Shuttles, similar to transit, we also have a pretty robust shuttle system that serves Caltrain. So these are routes that don't run all day. They're generally oriented towards peak times. They either augment capacity or provide a service that a fixed transit route maybe wouldn't provide normally. Major takeaways on this is just to understand that there's a real spectrum of types of shuttles that serve Caltrain. There are fully public ones that are open to everyone. They're publicly funded. They're operated by a publicly entity, all the way to the other end of the spectrum where you have fully private shuttles, not open to the public, no public dollars. And then there's a pretty broad range in between where you have some privately operated shuttles like the Stanford Marguerite that are open to the public. You have some public shuttles that have some private dollars involved. The way public shuttles work today, it's a complicated system. It's been built up over time. Samtrans and Caltrain are jointly undertaking a study at this point now to look at that system and think about how it can grow and change for the future. And that's important because shuttle ridership has been declining, even as Caltrain ridership has grown. Just a quick note on pickup and drop-off. We've seen drop-off really grow as a mode of access to the system. That's in part as some parking lots have gotten full, in part as Uber and Lyft have become a non-trivial part of how some people access our system. And then walking in by every pedestrian at some point when they're getting to Caltrain, there's a lot of the walking in bicycling environment that outside of our control, it relates to city streets or pieces of infrastructure that we may not own. But we're looking to invest quite a bit in bike parking. That's work that's ongoing now. And more generally, as we think about the pedestrian environment, as Caltrain grows in the future, and we have stations that are accommodating greater and greater volumes of people, there's quite a bit of work we'll need to do to programmatically upgrade our stations, expanding amenities and shelters, increasing the number of clipper readers that are at stations. Level boarding is an investment we're hoping to make in the future, improving wayfinding and signage. So a lot of work that'll happen, not necessarily as a single project, but over time at stations so that they can accommodate sort of ever larger volumes of passengers. The other piece of the access analysis we've done is to look not so much at today, but to look much further out into the future, really to the service vision, to think about kind of at just a real high directional level, how do we want to sort of strategically invest in access improvements? What is the access profile of our system going to look like in the future? And that's when we're talking about really adding tripling our ridership. You know, at some stations, that's going to mean the ridership is 10 times greater than it is today. So a real major change in what those stations could look like and the kinds of facilities they'll need to provide. And so the next few slides just provide a few different ways of how we can start to think about that in a big picture sense, looking at what does it cost per capita to provide access facilities? What does it cost to operate them on an ongoing basis? Thinking about which ones can really scale well to accommodate large crowds of people, thinking about which ones maybe are more sustainable. And to kind of help us think through all of that information in the long term, we've been using a tool called our Station Management Toolbox. This is a tool that was put together for us a couple of years ago using an FTA planning grant. It helps us kind of produce detailed models of station access and model what changes as we think about different policy interventions or investments at stations at both a station level and a system-wide level. So we've integrated data from the business plan into that tool to help us do some big picture modeling of station access going forward. There are basically three scenarios we looked at with this tool. We looked at sort of an ad hoc approach where we kind of continued to basically assume that Caltrain continues to invest in station access much as it does today, which is taking advantage of opportunities as they arise, but not necessarily having big concerted access investment programs. We looked at sort of one end of the spectrum where we invest heavily in new parking. So we grow our system and try to meet that demand with parking supply. And then we looked at the other end of the spectrum where we really didn't invest more in parking and instead invested in prioritizing multimodal access, invested heavily in joint development around our stations and to look at outcomes there. Generally what we found, and these are estimates, but they're modeled up at a pretty high level of kind of what access to the system could look like in 2040. We do see that there's differences in ridership outcomes depending on how we invest in access. When we invest in expanding parking supply, it actually doesn't really help our ridership. In fact, we found it hurts it a little bit. Parking is pretty space intensive. It's taking up space that could be used for joint development or for multimodal facilities. Conversely, if we were to really orient the system to non-auto access, we see that our ridership increases. In that scenario, we're improving transit connections to the system. We're increasing the number of people living near the station through joint development. And so you can also see on the right of the screen kind of how that would translate into change of access over time by mode. There are cost differences to the approaches as well. When we look at sort of the 50-year cost of building our system out one way or another, the cost of providing new structured parking on the peninsula is just humongous. That's made worse in Caltrain's case because at many stations we don't own the land that we needed to build parking structures. So you've got some really significant land land acquisition that would be part of having to build parking for all of that demand. And that's land that, again, could be used for other kinds of uses like housing or commercial development. There's a big investment needed to prioritize non-auto access as well. That's more on the operating costs, so the cost of running more shuttles or maintaining facilities over time rather than major capital investments. And then sort of a similar outcome on the kind of annual revenue side, where we would generate a substantial amount of revenue as our parking supply increases, but we would also generate a lot of revenue if we were to increase development at stations. And so that kind of provides some big picture thinking for Caltrain as we think about kind of how we may want to evolve our access programs in line with our overall service vision. And so the last few slides, this is not intended to result in really a finite recommendation. There's clearly more access planning and policy work for Caltrain to do down the road. But this starts to frame some of the key questions for Caltrain to think about and start to put the system in maybe a particular direction as we're thinking about how our access plans and policies may need to evolve in the future. The next section of the presentation is focused on an equity assessment that we've been working on. And this is sort of the first part of that material. The second part would come back to this committee next month in conjunction with the funding analysis that we're doing. To start, it's important to, I think, talk a little bit about why we're doing an equity assessment at all as part of this process. And there really are sort of three important reasons. The first is that we've heard very clearly from the board, as well as our stakeholders, that equity is important. It's a value that they want to see expressed through Caltrain's plans and policies. And so that is one of the reasons why we're doing this here. Another reason is that Caltrain is planning to grow. We do want to triple our ridership. And when we grow, when we think about growing our customer base, the best way to do that is to make sure that we're casting as wide a net as possible for our customers. So thinking about equity helps us think about what all of our potential customers need and making sure that we're catering to as broad of a market as we can. Finally, as we talk about building out Caltrain's vision, we are going to need public investment. And so part of the making the case for public investment is making the case that it benefits the entire public. And so those are kind of the broad reasons behind why we feel that it's important to do this work and why that's part of the business. The equity work we've been doing has three basic components to it. The first has been sort of looking at opportunities and challenges, and that's a lot of what I'll talk about today. We're then doing an analysis of the service vision through an equity lens, and so understanding areas where that vision will inherently advance equity versus areas where we may need to really think about adding some additional policy thought in or pairing it up with some other programs to make sure that we're advancing equity. And then finally, we'll be developing some specific recommendations for next steps or policy considerations for Caltrain as we complete business plan and continue with the work of the railroad. So when we did our sort of initial assessment of equity, we started by looking at a lot of existing plans in the corridor with really a focus on community-based transportation plans. These are planning documents that have been produced often by lower-income communities or communities of concern that focus on how different strategies and ways to improve access and transportation outcomes to those communities. So we started with a survey of those. We also did a good amount of stakeholder engagement, a lot of discussions with different community stakeholders, in-person meetings, phone interviews with representatives from various community-based organizations along the corridor. And the next few slides really summarize some of the key feedback that we received, both from reviewing those documents and talking with representatives of those informations or organizations. And so a variety of feedback on service and stations, a lot of it oriented towards providing a kind of more robust service throughout the day so that we're providing a really attractive service to folks who maybe aren't working or don't have traditional 9-to-5 work schedules, as well as more frequent service. Also, a lot of feedback about desires for new stations in community of concern, or making sure that those communities have good access to Caltrain stations. Station connections, there is, as I mentioned earlier, we do have a lot of folks of lower income who are relying on transit to connect to the Caltrain system. And so we definitely heard some feedback about that and making sure that those bus connections are working really well, as well as better pedestrian and bike connections in within neighborhoods of concern. Rider information was something that we heard, as well as accessibility of station design. Certainly heard about discounted fares and low-income fares, concerns about the zone fare system, interest in accumulator fares, and also certainly heard about more affordable housing near stations. I know that was a very active part of the TOD policy conversation, and it certainly came up here as well. Moving on from the stakeholder interviews, the next phase of major analysis we did was really digging into the data and trying to understand to what extent Caltrain's ridership is reflective of the folks who are living on the corridor, the folks who are working and commuting on the corridor, and using that data to help think through what are some potential areas where we could make changes or policy improvements that we could think about. So to do this, we used a lot of data from our recent 2019 triennial survey. So the data you're seeing about Caltrain riders in this presentation is very recent. And we matched that up with data from the census to look at who's living and working within the Caltrain corridor. So Caltrain does operate through a diverse corridor. We've got a number of households that are in communities of concern in the corridor. We have a lot of households who are low income. And we have a lot of residents in the corridor who are identified as being people of color. One of the things that we did find is that if you look at the population of folks who live within 2 miles of a Caltrain station, Caltrain ridership does look a little bit different than folks who are living in the corridor. So on when we look at the breakdown, Caltrain riders do tend to be higher income. And they generally tend to have more sort of white and Asian representation, and particularly fewer Latinx people who are riding the train compared to the people who live in the corridor. So the next question we really wanted to ask is, to what extent is Caltrain ridership reflective of people who are commuting in the corridor? So we know that there's a little bit of a difference between Caltrain and the folks who are living in the corridor, but what about the folks who are commuting for work trips? And so to do that, we looked at census data again and looked at basically all of the work trips that are happening within the corridor. And so this includes trips within the corridor. It also includes trips that are coming into the corridor or going out of the corridor. And interestingly, what we found there is that Caltrain ridership actually matches commuters in the corridor extremely closely. So we have a very close correspondence with people who are making work trips. And so this is an important finding in that it starts to tell us that Caltrain riders really do look like the working population in the corridor, but not necessarily like the overall population. And one of the things we were interested in finding is that that's true across all income levels. So it's not
Sebastian, can I interrupt you? This is Cindy. One thing is sometimes it's really hard to hear you, so I apologize if you can't hear me. But can you say more about the significance of this slide and the slide you had before? Because I missed what you were saying. You're a little garbled.
Yeah, I apologize. So this slide, we looked at population of people who are commuting in the Caltrain corridor. So this is census-based data, and we looked at everyone who's making a work trip within the corridor, from outside the corridor, into the corridor, or from inside the corridor, out of the corridor. And what we found when we compare that to the demographic of Caltrain riders is that they match closely. So Caltrain ridership is very representative of people who are making, all people who are making work trips in the corridor. And then on slide 61, the significance of that is one of the other things that we were sort of surprised to find when we looked at the census data is that the work trip behavior of people does not vary that much by income level in terms of folks who are working, making commute trips along the corridor or making commute trips into the corridor or who are making commute trips out of the corridor. There seems to be quite a bit of similarity regardless of the income level. And so the real takeaway from the data here was that the Caltrain system is not entirely representative of people who live around the stations, but it is highly representative of the working population. To kind of dig into that further, our next step was to look at a number of parallel transit routes. And so we looked at Muni, SamTrans, and VTA and picked out particular routes that have some degree of paralleling along the Caltrain corridor. So we didn't look at their whole systems. We looked at specific routes that mirror part of the Caltrain corridor, at least for a particular segment. And what we found there is that those systems and those routes really tilt in the opposite direction. So they tend to have a larger percentage of people who are of lower income. They have a larger percentage of their riders who are of people of color. And so there's a pretty significant disconnect between the Caltrain ridership versus the population of folks we see on parallel transit. We also see that whereas Caltrain is really focused on serving a commute market today, again, the opposite is true when we sort of look at the data from these parallel transit routes, where there you see these are routes that have high frequencies during the middle of the day versus Caltrain, where the frequency really drops down during the middle of the day. And similarly, these parallel transit routes also have, in fact, carry many of their riders in the middle of the day, whereas our ridership craters in the middle of the day. Some of them actually have their sort of peak loads during the middle of the day. So another piece of evidence that's starting to really suggest that part of what's going on is that Caltrain is almost exclusively serving commuters, and some of these parallel transit routes are predominantly serving a population of folks who are not making a traditional commute. And so that...
I have a question for clarification. When we were looking two or three slides ago, when we were comparing the commuters on Caltrain to the people living in the corridor that were commuting, were those people commuting within other transit districts, or were they commuting on Caltrain as well?
So, is it slide 60 that we were asking about?
Yes, that's right.
So when it says riders, those are Caltrain riders.
Right,
when
it's the other column that I'm asking about.
So that is the entire population of people making work trips as pulled from the census.
But so work trips on Caltrain or work trips on other transit?
Work trips overall. So they may be on transit. Many of them are going to be driving. It's
okay. There are people who are going to work one direction and coming back in the evening. Okay. So we're saying that's these income are matched with those people who are commuting on Caltrain.
Right. Yeah. The way I would phrase it is that the Caltrain ridership is highly representative of the overall working
commute. Okay. That clarifies my confusion. Okay. Thank you.
So where some of this data helps us point, and it's really kind of prefigures the work that will be coming next month, is to start to think about different elements of our service where there are either policy interventions or changes we may be able to consider or want to look at if we wanted to sort of improve some of the equity outcomes for Caltrain, if we wanted a system that was not only representative of workers, but really of the kind of the entire population in the corridor. One of the big ones, which is what I've been alluding to, is that today Caltrain service is very, we serve a lot of commuters and we run a service that is extremely commuter oriented. And so one of the biggest potential takeaways we're seeing from this is that improving our service during off-peak hours, non-traditional commute hours, whether that's the middle of the day, earlier in the morning, later in the evening, is something that would make our system much more useful to folks who want to use it for things other than 9-to-5 work trips, whether those are sort of atypical schedule work trips or whether it's other kinds of trips. We're right now not really providing the kind of service that makes us necessarily really attractive to those markets. And so that's a major change, and it's something that we've talked about doing in other parts of the business plan, so a real opportunity. We did look a little bit at comparing travel time and cost between Caltrain and some of the parallel transit routes that parallel us. And so that's another area for us to put some thought into. Generally, Caltrain is faster, and generally, Caltrain costs more as compared to other routes that are traveling for a similar portion of the system. That's not universally true. There's some nuances in terms of how the fare structures compare, but that's certainly another area for us to focus in on, is to what extent are we kind of providing a premium service where it's a faster time, but also a higher cost. Looking at cost and fare structure more generally, as many members are well aware, we're about to launch our participation in the Clipper Smart program. And so we will start providing a low-income discount pass, but certainly continuing to think about those kinds of programs and understanding how those fit in are going to be an important part of the picture. And then thinking in general about how our discount pass programs are used, whether those are the monthly pass or the go pass, relative to our sort of one-way or daily ticket sales. This is not new data. This kind of came out in the fare study before, but right now the deeper discount programs tend to be ones that are also more accessible to people of higher incomes. People who may be able to afford a monthly pass are the ones who are getting the most discount versus folks who are having to pay as they go are not necessarily getting that discount. And so thinking about how our fare structure evolves to ensure that any discounts we are providing are going to be sort of equally accessible to folks is another area for us to think about going forward. And then station access. I touched on this earlier, but we do see differences in terms of how different income groups are accessing our system. And right now, folks of lower income tend to use transit to get to Caltrain at a higher rate. And so making sure that we're investing in those kinds of transit connections, designing our service in a way that really promotes those kinds of transit connections, is another way to make sure that we're catering to folks who really need to use transit to get to and from the system. So making sure that that's kind of first in our thinking around first and last mile. Part of that is designing the system and designing the connections. Another part of it is thinking about how those connections work within the context of a fare structure and a fare system. So today, the discounts are generally kind of one way. A number of our partner agencies will accept, have various discount programs if a rider is coming from Caltrain. So thinking about how that might be more uniform and it might flow both ways in the future, or other kinds of programs that could be used to sort of make sure that that transfer between Caltrain and other systems is seamless and isn't economically penalizing one. And then finally, just thinking about the kind of connectivity that transit connections offer. This was another thing that kind of came out of the research that we did, is that a lot of folks were using transit to get to and from Caltrain may have limited mobility, or they may really need that higher density transit, the rubber tire connections, to get to where they're ultimately going. So that's another way we're sort of prioritizing transit as part of our access policy, really helps ensure accessibility to a lot of folks. And so this is, again, this is kind of the first part of the two-part presentation. We'll be coming back with more, but one of the things, these are just sort of some initial thoughts based on what we're seeing in the data and what we're hearing from stakeholders and through our research of areas where Caltrain could begin to think about some projects and policy interventions that would help improve the equity outcomes of the system. Sort of next month, and just looking ahead a little bit, so like I said, we'll be looking sort of at the long-range service vision and thinking about as we embark on a sort of a multi-decade program of evolving the system, how can we make sure that we're keeping equity front of mind throughout that process? What are different measures to look at? Which ones, you know, raise a flag of knowing that they're going to be an ongoing tension or challenge that we'll really have to pay attention to. So these are just some of the measures that we're looking at. We're doing this in awareness of what MTC is doing at a regional level, and obviously also thinking about some of the federal equity standards around Title VI that are out there as well. So that's coming, and we'll develop a more cohesive set of recommendations based on that and the material you've seen today. And that's it. I apologize if it was hard to hear me and for the presentation staff who at the front end of this. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. You did a great job. For the most part, I could hear you. What I'd like to do is open it up for clarifying questions from my board colleagues, committee colleagues, and then after keeping it tightly to clarifying questions, we'll open it up for comments from the public, and Dora will explain how that's going to be done in a second, and then we'll come back and have comments from committee members. So with that, Director Zamuda, do you have any clarifying questions?
Yes. With respect to the low income or the equity issue, we're one of the transit districts that's partnering with others to look at this through MTC, I believe. Has that started yet? And is there any data thus far?
So the Clipper, it's been, if I understand correctly, it's the Clipper Smart Program, which is the low income discount that has not started yet. We'll start soon, and there will be an item that will come both to this committee and the board around that. Really, they've, as I understand it, the start date has been pushed out a little bit because of the COVID situation.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Is that all, Director Zamuda?
I think so. So all far. Right.
Director Chavez, any clarifying questions?
Sorry, I think no, thank you.
Okay, all right. With that, Dora, would you explain to everyone how we're going to handle public comment and then proceed? Thank you.
Thank you. This is clarification for those who are attending. Please note that we are accepting public comment only as set forth in the meeting agenda. Accordingly, comments sent in via email before the meeting has been forwarded to the board and will be posted to the Caltrain website with materials for this meeting. Emails sent later will be posted into the board's weekly correspondence, also posted online. For members of the public participating via Zoom, please post your comments or questions into the Q&A section, and it will be read out loud. We are not using the chat or raise your hand functions. Thank you. We do have several comments at the moment. The first commenter is from Jeff Carter. He said, thank you for addressing the issue of access to Caltrain. This will be an important aspect in building future ridership. All modes, walking, bike, driving, and transit need to be expanded. Expanding transit access will be a challenge in lower density peninsula cities. Transit will need to be frequent and cover Caltrain operating hours. Considering lack of transit funding, how is this sustainable? He also goes on to say, thank you for addressing the poor off-peak and evening schedule. This can be a major deterrent to improving non-traditional ridership. In coordinating schedules, I would urge caution. There needs to be a good mix of local, express, and bullet service. Hence the need for maximum amount of passing tracks through multiple stations. This would include express service during off-peak and evening hours. We also have several raised hands. I am waiting for them to submit their comments in writing.
Dora, can you explain to them one more time how they should do that?
Yes. Public commenters who are attending via Zoom should put their comments into the Q&A section of Zoom, or you may submit them via publiccomment@caltrain.com. I did see a comment from Mr. Roland LeBrun. He states that I raised my hand to speak. He goes on to say, you are in violation of the governor's executive order. I also saw some raised hands from Adina Levine. I don't see the comment yet. And from Drew.
Okay, Drew and Ms. Levin, if you would like to make a comment, please use the function as Dora has outlined.
I just, through the chair, excuse me. I just received Adina Levin's comments. She says, thank you very much for directing these connectivities and equity studies and good staff recommendations. We are pleased to see how the studies show the potential benefits of improving fare structure, including but not only means-based fares, increased all-day frequency, and improving fare and schedule integration as a means of improving equity as well as the ease of use for all customers. We also understand that with the Bay Area's current funding and governance structure, achieving a more integrated system has challenges. We urge Caltrain to participate actively in broader initiatives for fare schedule integration with a goal of improving equitable access and ease of use for all customers. Especially with ridership drop caused by COVID-19 crisis, Caltrain and Bay Area Transit would benefit from providing more seamless service to attract riders back to the transit system while diversifying ridership. Lastly, we saw that the study showed input about affordable housing, but the recommendations do not yet cover this topic. We would urge additional steps, including the use of value capture in areas with major capital programs to include affordable housing and guidelines similar to BART's TOD guidelines to support increased density and affordable housing in areas accessible to Caltrain, land not owned by Caltrain, and other measures to support TOD and prevent displacement associated with capital projects. Thank you for your consideration, Adina Levin, for Friends of Caltrain, and partners including Transform, Spur, Seamless Bay Area, Urban Habitat, San Francisco Transit Riders, and SV at Home.
Are there any other comments?
Drew says, I have a comment, but he is on an iPad mini, so he's having difficulty typing it. And Mr. LeBrun cited, he said he will cite you with a violation of the Brown Act as soon as I located the text in the governor's executive order dated March 20th. That concludes the current comments as of this time.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. I do want to express to folks that this is our first attempt at this, and we are doing the best we can. I'm sure that as this becomes more the norm for the next few weeks, months, who knows, we'll get much better at it. We certainly had our first session of the Belmont City Council the other evening via Zoom, and it was not exactly what I would call smooth. And I know we'll do better next time. So I appreciate if folks would be a little patient with us. I promise you, we want to hear from the public, and we appreciate their comments. And thank you to those who listened to Dora and sent their comments in the way that we can take them right now. With that, I'd like to open it back up for comments from my colleagues, starting with Director Chavez.
I think most important is just to say I really appreciate the work that went into this. And I know you're producing slides because you're doing a lot of the detail work on the backup materials. I'm really interested in learning more about this particular area, in part because it makes sense that the alignment going through what are the wealthier parts of the county. I mean, I'm sorry, Niobrara counties, that they would have a higher level of ridership by people who make more money. That wasn't a super surprise. What was fascinating was how people get there. I don't know that I would have exactly understood that, but it makes sense because it would be interesting to see this on a graph to better understand where low income people are living and how they then get to our service. So that was there was a lot of food for thought there. So thank you for that, and I'll look forward to seeing much more detail. It also makes me think, though, just for my colleagues, and this is actually something, Director Stone, that you've raised a number of times, where you've talked about how we think about our fare policy relative to real access. And it's not just going to be the fare policy, but the real question, I've thought about access really, really focused on fare policy. But the truth of the matter, access is more complicated than the fare policy, as evidenced by the staff's research. So anyway, I'll look forward to more discussion. But it brought to a big point, Director Stone, what you've been really reminding us to think about. Thank you.
Thank you. And Director Zamuda.
Yes, I was surprised and actually pleased to see early on in the slides where we were looking at how passengers travel to and from Caltrain for their commute. And what I noted is that the numbers of people who are walking has significantly increased in the last several years. And I think that fact or that trend needs to be considered once we look at parking and whether we need additional parking or less parking, whether we should be doing something with those stations expand them so more people can walk to the stations and so forth. So I will be interested to see what we're going to be doing with respect to parking and as we expand our various stations. And then secondly, the question of the low income and the fares being different in all of the various different transit districts and how it's mostly cheaper for people to go through their own county transportation as opposed to Caltrain is also something I think it needs to be studied further. And unless we're able to either reduce our fare to match that, I just don't see that we'll be able to attract those people who are currently using their VTA or Muni or Samtrans way of commuting because of the cost.
All right, thank you very much. I'll echo the comments of both of my colleagues. I think the parking discussion is, for me, kind of one of the most fun ones we're gonna have. It's so in terms of philosophical angles and pragmatic effects. I'll leave it there right now because I know this is going to be back to us, I suspect, more than one time on various different places we sit, and I'll have a lot more comments in the future. But Sebastian, I do want to thank you for your work on this. This is exactly the type of stuff we should be talking about, and I can tell that you and your team put a ton of work in. And with that, we will move on to item number 6, which is an update on the 25th Avenue grade separation Hillsdale Station closure.
And I'll just introduce this very quickly while Rafael Bolon, the project manager, is teeing things up. It's a real good time to have an update on this project. We're making very good progress, and one of the main I'll say one of the main things that is going to accelerate or was used to accelerate the work on the project is that we will be closing the station for a period of time and moving service to Belmont. So one of the important things that I think folks have been waiting for is understanding when that closure is anticipated to take place. And so Raphael's going to give us an update not only on construction progress, but also work we've done with the communities around implementing that closure as it stands. I will say one thing, and I'll probably repeat it at the end. When we talk about some of the mitigations for the closure of the station, it needs to be understood that is what is anticipated today. And I think it certainly anticipates that we'll be through the current crisis. And so we'll probably have to update folks on not the date of the closure, but certainly on some of the mitigations as we see transit service levels change. So with that, Raphael, I'll hand it over to you.
Perfect. Thank you. So as Michelle mentioned, I'm going to give a brief update on the project, and really the focus will be on the temporary closure that's coming up here in May. So a little bit about the project. It ultimately is a safety improvement project to grade separate the existing crossing at 25th. But in addition, we're building two new vehicular crossings, one each at 28th and 31st, to improve east-west connectivity, as well as a ped and bike underpass at the station and a new Hillsdale station, which will be located starting at 28, about 1,000 feet north of the existing station. In addition, I will touch briefly on, there is a parking track that was located within the project limits and had to be relocated to the 10th through 14th area off of Railroad to the west side of the tracks. Overall benefits for the project, as I mentioned, primarily safety, but also improved east-west connectivity and reduced train noise without crossing as well as at the station. So the project is located roughly between Hillsdale as the southern limit and State Route 92, which is just south of Hayward Park Station. It includes five structures, which we just label A through E for E's sake. And then the parking track that I mentioned, which is not been constructed, but has recently been approved by the city to go at this location. So it will be constructed between 10th and 14th. This will be a separate construction contract, but the timeline will be coincidental with the overall construction contract. And that's on purpose to utilize economies of scale with regards to construction management, project management, et cetera. Here's a rendering of what the final project will look like. Right in the middle of the screen is the centerboard platform with the shelters. There will be one ramp on each side of the platform and one stairhead on either end as well. So the platform will be accessed via 28th or through the pedestrian / bike access point on the southern limit. So what have we been doing? The last time we've updated this board was really almost a year ago. And during that time, we've done a lot of work in the field. We've completed all the retaining walls. The main MSC walls are now in place. We've installed all the bridge structures. And we've actually started placing skeleton track on top of the grade separation. We've also began lowering the roads on the west side. We can't begin lowering the east side yet because we're still operating on the at-grade tracks. But on the west side, we've partially lowered to 30%. And we've just started work on the new Hillsdale station. Here's some shots, some of which are a little bit. You can see on the left side is a shot of the grade step, sort of a drone view. It's a little bit older since then. We've paved it, put a whole bunch of ballast on it, and have began constructing the track itself. On the other side, you see some of the structures going in. For those of you who are interested, you can see those on our website. There's actually a time lapse, which lets you see the two-night activity, you know, sped up in 5 minutes. So the other work that we're doing, as I mentioned, is lowering the roads. So in order to go under at 28th, the roads have to sag starting at El Camino Real, go underneath the new Great Sup railroad tracks, and then come back up. So on your left is 28th Avenue. So it's a cast-in-place wall. You can see it going in there right now. That's the last segment we need to pour out, and then we'll just backfill and construct the road. And on the other side, you can see some of the track being placed up top. I refer to it as skeleton track, by which you can see we've placed ballast with the track on top, but we haven't filled in the cribs and actually got it stabilized yet. That will happen in April. And then at the station, the view on the right is, that's actually lightweight material that we just used to fill it. The large cylinder you see is the foundation for the electrified pole, and the small ones you see are for the light. Since that picture was taken, we've subsequently poured that slab out, so it now looks different. It actually looks like a completed slab, ready to go. Funding-wise, this is a $180 million project. The bulk of the funds come from two sources. They come from, $84 million comes from California High-Speed Rail, and $74 million comes from our own TA. And then there's $10 million that is earmarked from a grade set fund from PUC 190, as well as $12 million, which is directly contributed from the city of San Jose. And so now, briefly on the update for the closure. So we will be closing the existing Hillsdale station temporarily for up to 6 months, starting May 16th, 2020. The reason we're doing this is the minimum amount of time that we can effectuate building a brand new station, completing 28th Avenue, which is required to access the new station platform, and building all the parking for the new station. And to do the rail cutover, which essentially means transferring the service from where it is at grade now to up top. The first of those cutovers is timed right now for Memorial Day, allowing us to take advantage of the long weekend to ensure success on that. And I should mention, as Michelle did, that obviously we're still, you know, the whole COVID-19 situation is evolving, and so all these dates are predicated on no additional shutdowns as far as construction. As it stands today, we are working out in the field, work continues, and so these dates are holding. So what we did to get forward for the survey last summer on ridership, and then of course we correlated that against our annual counts, and we looked at not just who rides our train, but what their preferred mode would be in this temporary shutdown, and whether they would ride the train or whether they would elect to use some other method. And based off of that, as well as other feedback that we received from cities, from elected officials, et cetera, we compiled a plan for what it would take to mitigate the impacts to the extent we could during the shutdown. We also have been speaking to specific stakeholders who have a particular interest in the access, such as the Nueva School, as well as some of the employers that are in that area and are heavily Caltrain dependent. So essentially what the plan is gonna be is that during the shutdown, service that goes to Hillsdale will go to Belmont. So Belmont is a local station at this point. It will now receive the limited service that Caltrain has, and so it will effectively become an express for Baby Bullet stop. There will be free parking at Belmont Station during this period to hopefully mitigate some of the impact. As well, bus service between Belmont and San Mateo, as well as other select routes from Hillsdale to San Mateo, et cetera, will be free with a Caltrain pass. And the El Camino Real bus is intended to be the primary mode of transfer between Hillsdale and Belmont. So basically, if your final destination is Hillsdale, or you walked to Hillsdale normally and you're not able or willing to travel to Belmont, then this shuttle service, the bus service rather, will provide transfer to Belmont, and will be free with your for Caltrain riders. There will also be a peak period shuttle service that's running on the east side. So this will run up Delaware through the current, just immediately opposite where the current station is, and then to Belmont. We are suffering from a severe shortage of drivers right now. So this is pending that being achievable. But as we stand, that is meant to buttress the primary mean of transit, which is the SamTrans service. So to summarize, if you drove to Hillsdale, we'd ask that you drive to Belmont in this interim and get on Caltrain. If you were dropped off, the same thing. If you biked from all the way on the north side of, let's just say 92, or you walked, or your final destination is Hillsdale, and you would like to continue that route, then we would ask that you take the SamTrans El Camino Real bus, or if not practical for you, the shuttle from the east side. We will also coordinate with what we're calling the private shuttles that access areas. Again, there are a number of shuttles that use Hillsdale parking lot. We're working with them to move that service temporarily to Belmont. How have we been telling people? So myriad of ways. So there's the most basic is physical signage that is on the platform now, and it's got a sort of countdown going for when the closure of the actual platform will occur. We've also been doing windshield drops, and ambassadors will be at the station in the weeks coming up to the closure just to make sure we get everybody, as well as conductor announcements, seat drops, et cetera. There's also a parallel effort to let the entire community know. I mentioned some of it where we're reaching out to specific stakeholders. We're starting the overall effort today by this meeting, but it'll be followed up with meetings with other cities, with our own board, City of San Mateo and others, of course, as well as a virtual town hall that will be held on April 9th. We had a lot of success with this format last time. It really lets everybody get their questions in. So I guess we're early pioneers in doing it online. And then we have a dedicated webpage, which is just about the closure and is focused on stuff directly related to how this impacts people. Where you can get more information, as I mentioned, there is a website. And then for just overall project issues, there's the 25th Avenue Great Stuff website as well. And with that, I could take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Rafael. Director Zamuda, any questions?
I'm just curious, in terms of volume, how many riders on a daily basis from Hillsdale now that will be then using the other station?
I'm sorry, was the question how many riders are there in general?
Yeah, approximately daily riders from Hillsdale.
So I actually don't have that in front of me right now. I apologize. Okay. I can get that for you. I know Hillsdale is one of our most traveled. I want to say it's, Michelle can correct me, but it's either our fourth or fifth most traveled station.
Yeah, it is up there. And I think, Director Zamuda, what we can also provide you is information regarding the estimates of people we think will be actually using the bus service versus parking at the Belmont station.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, and I could wait till the board meeting.
That's it?
Yes.
Okay, Director Chavez, I'm seeing a shake of the head, no. All right, that was great. Rafael, thank you for that. And also thank you from what I understand, strapping on Kevlar vest, jacket, and pants to go to some community meetings where people were maybe less than as kind as I would hope they were to you over the last several months. And I want you and your team to know that I appreciate, one, your willingness to really dig into the issue of how some of the issues related to this station that are unavoidable were going to be handled with regard to set out parking tracks and looking for alternatives and trying to find them and working hand in hand with the City of San Mateo through some really tough issues, and also a huge shout out to the leaders in San Mateo who stepped up to make what I think was a very good decision to help mitigate some of some effects of those choices. Not a perfect world we live in, not a perfect project, but at the end of the day, it's going to be huge in terms of both what it does for Caltrain and the city of San Mateo. It's going to make Caltrain safer by separating the grades. It's going to make it easier for Caltrain to be faster down the road by separating the grades. It's going to make it better for traffic crossing east and west. They don't have to stop for arms going down. And it's also going to create connectivity between the Bay Meadows neighborhood and the west side of San Mateo, which is something that's been needed for a long time. So that's all I have. I really like the transparency, and I really like the website. That's all great stuff. Last call for comments before we go on to the next item. Anybody? Shakes or nods of the head will do.
Yes.
Thank you. Oh, before we get into public comment for this item, Madam Clerk, as I understand it, we had a couple of comments come in either late or we didn't see them for the last item. Unless there's a huge legal reason not to, Ms. Kasman weighs in and says not to do it, I would like to have you read those comments for the last item.
Yeah, please do, Dora.
Okay, thank you. Excuse me while I look back. There was a comment from Drew asking for clarification why they cannot raise their hand to speak for comment. Excuse me, I'm scrolling. Alita Dupree asked, can we look at more zones and accumulator passes? Mr. Adrian Brandt said, Caltrain needs to address the long overdue massive fare inequities built into the current tariff and zone structure. As Sebastian's slides showed, a short one-station stop ride from Redwood City to Menlo Park costs the same as a long ride from Redwood City to San Francisco to exclamation points. Even more outrageous, it costs more than a ride from Redwood City to SFO. Changing to equitable distance-based fares would be 1, revenue neutral, 2, offer excellent data and statistics on origin, destination ridership, and 3, would be easy to implement via a programming change to TVMs. BART has since its inception used a distance-based fare structure using fare matrix. It is essential that Caltrain make this change to allow for more interpeninsula trips to be made equitably. Pay for what you use, simple and fair. Revenue neutral if implemented with correct base plus mileage fare. Thank you.
All right, those are the comments for the last item.
Yes.
Go ahead and read the comments for this item.
Thank you. Please bear with me. Mr. Jeff Carter says high fares and the current zone system are also a major deterrent to increasing low and middle income ridership. An accumulator system is needed ASAP for low-income customers so that they can take advantage of the monthly pass. Since Caltrain has increased the monthly multiplier, monthly tickets have decreased significantly. Roland states, I raise my hand to speak. He said, you are in violation of the governor's order. He also goes on to state the public may observe and address the meeting by telephone or other electronic means, for example, Zoom and telephonic call-in, etc. He said the slide of funding showing Prop 1A is incorrect. The $84 million funding came from cap-and-trade funding because this project does not qualify for Prop 1A funding. A copy of the funding agreement has been sent to the board multiple times, but Samtrans continue to present incorrect information. He said, I have an entire page of comments on the business plan presentation. I would appreciate if you could unmute me. I do have other speakers as well.
Okay, is that everything?
I'm sorry, I need to scroll back for it. Ms. Adina Levine said, recommendations do not yet cover this topic, we would urge additional steps, including use of value capture in areas with major capital programs to include affordable housing and guidelines similar to BART's TOD. Is this a repeat? To support increased density and affordable housing in areas accessible to Caltrain on land not owned by Caltrain. I'm sorry, this is a repeat? Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Ms. Levine also emailed in a question. Will the changes described to be added in the GTSF data feed that appears in people's apps, so those apps will have current information about schedules and fares for the trips, question mark. Also, the idea of including express bus service with a Caltrain pass is a great idea to consider for the future. This is another example of a fare integration that might look on the surface to reduce ridership, but might increase it. Thanks. Adina Levin, Friends of Caltrain. Excuse me while I do one more check. I believe that is it for the comments.
Okay, thank you very much. Just real quick, I want folks again to understand that we're doing this on the fly. You know, if you work for Facebook or Google, you're probably really used to conducting and participating in Zoom meetings. But on the government side, we meet in person because we've been required to. So this isn't a normal thing. We're doing the best we can. However, several times now, the governor's executive order has been misquoted. And so I just want to quote it properly. What it says is, if a local legislative body or state body holds a meeting via teleconferencing and allows members of the public to observe and address the meeting telephonically or otherwise electronically, and then it goes on to say some other things. The members of the public in this meeting are being allowed to address us electronically. It may not be the way that they want to. It may not even be the way that we want it to happen yet. We're going to figure that out. But we are, in my opinion, in compliance with the governor's executive order. And unless our legal counsel tells us we're not, we're going to keep going the way we are. So, Ms. Kasman, do you have any concerns right now?
I have no concerns. You are in full compliance with the Brown Act.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And then we will turn back to my board colleagues for comments on the item, starting with Director Zimmerman.
I don't have any comments. Thank you.
I'm seeing a shake of the head from Director Chavez as well. I managed to mute myself before I wanted to. Sorry about that. As I said, we're getting used to this, and we'll have it down in no time, I'm sure. So with that, we'll move on to item number...
Excuse me, through the chair?
Yes.
We just received one other public comment. It's a question from Alita Dupree. How is COVID-19 affecting the electrification project?
Well, if that is specific to the 25th Avenue Grade Separation, Hillsdale Station... part of the electrification project, I think we could take it now. Otherwise, it might. The next item is finance and ridership updates relating to COVID-19. So I guess what I'll ask is if staff would like to respond to that in the framework of the Hillsdale 25th Avenue grade separation, yeah. Please do so.
It really covers under item 7. We'll be addressing general information related to that topic.
That's what I suspected. Okay, so then we'll move on to item number 7, which is finance and ridership updates relating to COVID-19. And who's going to take us through this item?
You want to start, Jim?
I'll just give a brief introduction. CFO Derek Hansel will be giving the presentation. As you know, we are in an extraordinary circumstance due to the coronavirus pandemic. The major employers in our area before our counties and state issued orders requiring people to stay at home unless they were in an essential service, the major employers were out ahead of that and had their employees to the extent they could working at home, many of whom were customers of ours. Then the six counties, three of which covering our service area, issued orders to stay at home except for essential services. and then the state issued its own order. The orders for the three counties for our service area are set to expire April 7. However, it's fully believed that they will be extended. The state order is without an end date, declared as indefinite and subject to change based upon how the governor may see things down the line. The long and short of it is our ridership is dramatically down, as is the ridership around the state, and in particular in our region. Revenues are accordingly way down, and we've made service adjustments, but we are not sure how long this is going to persist, and we felt it would be important to give you both the finance and a ridership update at this time and talk a little bit about what we're doing to try to mitigate the current situation.
Great. So this is a slightly updated presentation from a presentation, which is hopefully coming up soon, that we gave to the Finance Committee on Monday. So I apologize, Director Zamuda, but you get to see it a couple times.
That's fine. Thank you.
Let's see here. Great. Thank you. So
the presentation is now complete.
Hang on. There we go. Back a page, please.
Start where you can, Derek.
Or not. Okay. Yeah, it really be. Can you? All right. I'll start with page 3, and then they'll go back. It's important to note the fare composition, which has actually changed a little bit. There they go. Sorry. Maybe. Okay. Let's start with ridership. To Jim's point, you know, we started noticing the drop in one-way and day pass ticket sales, which are most sensitive to changes in ridership preference, what the companies are doing, you know, right at the very end of February. So you can see literally kind of the first 4 days of the last week in February, you know, the total one way and day pass tickets, you know, doubling up the day pass for a round trip. We're really pretty consistent with what we would have expected for this time of the year. Friday, we usually have a drop off on Friday. We don't usually have that much of a drop off. And so, you know, we started seeing it then. You start seeing then notable drop offs the week of March 2nd, continuing, the week of the 9th. And then, obviously ridership just absolutely cratering, with, the orders, that came out, beginning, last week. So right now, we're sell, you know, where we would typically sell north of 20,000 one-way tickets a day, we're hovering a little over 1,000 one-way tickets a day. This just shows the change in the revenue composition over the past several years, explains our sensitivity to these revenues. We get about 75% of our fare box revenue from the sale of daily passes and monthly passes. We have steadily been increasing, as folks know, GoPass pricing, so that on a per passenger mile basis, it's more equitable with the other fare products, and that's led to a significant increase in the revenue composition of the GoPass product. That's actually been working to our advantage right now because you know, we sold almost $30 million worth of GoPasses for calendar 2020, and that revenue sits in our accounts right now. just as a quick reminder, you know, what's the composition of our overall budget on both a revenue side and then, you know, how do we spend the money? We get nearly 70% of our operating funds out of the farebox. So when we lose the kind of money that we're losing in farebox revenues, it's very, very challenging. Our costs are predominantly the cost of the TASI operating contract. That represents about 60% of the $155 million operating budget. As I mentioned just a second ago, the GoPass sales for calendar 2020 represent nearly $30 million. And so, frankly, the good news is we started the year with a reasonably good cash position. If this had happened at a different time of the year, it would have been much more challenging. But nonetheless, it is super challenging because non-GoPass fares represent more than $7 million a month. And again, we're losing a lot of that in the current month, and April will be worse as we, frankly, expect that monthly pass sales will be extremely low. So, bottom line, we anticipate losing as much as 90% of the non-GoPass fare revenue. Frankly, it could be even a little more. Again, from the perspective of financial liquidity, we did begin this period with a healthy cash cushion. But not having any revenue or not having very little revenue come in on the farebox side is very, very challenging and will continue to be challenging, we think, for some period of time. We did made a $10 million draw against the operating line of credit we've got with JP Morgan. We do have $20 million of that credit line remaining. We need some greater certainty as to revenue, including help from our friends at the federal government to be able to access that. So that's just continues to be a bit of a challenge. We do have several other liquidity levers that we frankly have pulled and could pull. We have the managing agency relationship. As you know, Caltrain is staffed by the San Mateo County Transit District staff. And currently we're holding a $20 million invoice on the SamTrans side that's due from Caltrain. There's also the capital line of credit that we've got for the electrification project. We currently have no balance outstanding on the electrification project line of credit. That's something, again, we could draw on, but we do need to get some things cleared up as to the federal funding a little bit first. And then finally, state rail assistance. You may remember that we came to the board and asked to draw down $8 million of state rail assistance for use as part of the match for the TRSIP grant for purchase of additional EMUs. We also have a $20 million credit line associated with that we've not drawn down. We could reprogram the SRA money to operating funding as necessary and then tap that line of credit for the TRSIP match were that to be required. So long story short, we can get through March fine. We can get through April fine. May gets more challenging, some harder levers to pull. June becomes very, very difficult. So with that, I want to let Michelle talk a little bit about what she's done and what she's thinking about doing.
Sure. Thank you, Derek. So as you can imagine, with this financial situation, we've been working as an operating team to try and figure out how to be as nimble as we possibly could be and make smart decisions with respect to keeping requisite service out on the street. But it became pretty obvious that, 92 trains a day were in no way, shape, or form going to be necessary to carry the number of riders, even with the type of physical distancing that was being required by the emergency order. So effective on the 17th, we did reduce all of the baby bullet service out of the schedule. The choice for that was fairly simple. In these days, we are looking at providing frequency at stations and coverage And we're not finding that people are really needing to get from A to B very quickly. It's more about taking those essential trips. And so really, that's what we've been focused on. We've been focused on providing essential service for requisite essential trips that are required during this time. With that reduction in service to 70 trains, we were able to advance things like state of good repair work, as well as refresher training for crews. I think it's worth mentioning, you know, these are very difficult decisions because we have a lot of skills on the railroad that are that require certification and in some cases several months of training. And so we've got to be really careful about making decisions that would need us to furlough workers or pay or have them not working on the property in case they might leave and go get another job somewhere else, of course. So, you know, in trying to also take a look at what we could possibly do, the construction program, including PCEP, is continuing to work. What we are doing is since the 17th, we're allowing single tracking on most of the right-of-way and most of the day. So we're trying to provide even more opportunity to get work done. And, you know, it's been a short time, so we're still trying to figure out, you know, how the contractors will best avail themselves of that additional access. And I think you saw the slope of the line, which really kind of caused us in short order after reducing service on the 17th to really think about what the next cut would be. So I think this is the first time that we've actually announced that on Monday the 30th, in line with some other of our Bay Area agencies, we'll be announcing an additional service cut, which would essentially take us to a little bit more than hourly service during the weekday. So 42 trains. We are planning currently to keep weekend service the same as it is. That's basically every 90 minutes. And so that's in view of really not needing to have 70 trains out on the right-of-way and really looking to recoup any cost savings where we possibly can. So we'll be working through the details of that service reduction over the course of the next few days, with view of implementing it for the first time on Monday the 30th. So with that, I'll hand it back to you, Derek.
Thanks. Obviously, it's important to recognize that this challenge is not only to Caltrain and to all our units of local government, but our partners, something that we cared certainly a lot about. We know that jobless claims are spiking. The last thing I saw was expectations that new jobless claims for last week are going to be somewhere north of 2 million nationally. I think I saw 500,000 just in one state alone, and that's not California. So, you know, I think that 2 million may be well short of the right number. Sales tax, which all of our funding partners are heavily dependent on, is likely declining significantly from the first quarter of calendar 20. Here I say the odds of recession are increasing greatly. Frankly, I think most of us who look at this carefully think we're probably well into the recession at this point. There has been significant public transit representation lobbying the state and federal governments for support of our infrastructure and public transit generally. You know, there is a significant amount of money for public transit in the bill that hopefully gets through the Senate, if not tonight, then tomorrow, and then the House and the White House. But again, we're heavily dependent on that happening in order to recoup very significant lost revenues and allow us to continue to roll the service out on a daily basis. So with that, we're available for any questions.
All right. Thank you, Derek. My first question to you is, how much have you aged in the last 2 weeks?
my hair's still not that gray, but it's certainly been a rough few weeks, I think, for all of us. None of us are sleeping well. I know the early morning emails I get from Jim seem to be earlier every day, so it's been rough, frankly.
Well, I want you to know that we all appreciate it, and I know it's a scary time, especially for those in any financial role in any sector, but especially government. And so with that, I'll open it up to clarifying questions from my colleagues. Director Chavez? No questions. Director Zamuda, you're still muted. If you have questions, unmute yourself.
Yes. Why did you choose to eliminate the bullet train when you did your first round of service reductions?
Yeah, because what we are finding is the value of time that our customers are having was not as high, and so the idea is we could eliminate those trains easily and still provide with the two remaining limited trains, so trains that are making some skip stops but not as many as the baby bullet, that could provide both the frequency and the coverage of all of the stations that were required. The baby bullets weren't driving ridership at that point.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, let's have public comment now then.
Currently, we have one speaker, Roland. He said, as I said earlier, this worked fine at the finance meeting, but the agency in charge of Caltrain administration did not like the public comments. He goes on to say, correction, the agency currently in charge of Caltrain administration. Ridership tanked at about the same time as the baby bullets were removed from the schedule. You cannot use the capital line of credit of operations. With regards to the $20 million in managing agency invoices is concerned, the solution is to terminate the existing agency.
Anything further from the public?
Yes. Jeff Carter, I believe board members and staff have been emailed my comments earlier today. This relates to the question I asked at Monday's Finance Committee meeting. Since this must already exist to create the charts, can the Excel spreadsheets be included in the presentation or agenda packet as backup information? Thank you. There are several more comments. Roland, correction, you cannot use the capital line of credit for operations. Adrian,
okay, Brandt. Dora, hold on.
Yes.
Folks, do not get multiple bites at the apple. So if they have made their comment, they've made their comment. They go, don't get to come back and make second comments, okay? So each person has one shot at commenting on each item. They're not going to get essentially to come back up to the microphone.
Thank you. The next commenter is Adrian Brandt. He says, thank you. I understand. I see Director Stone was kind enough to allow you to read the overlooked comments into the committee. Take care and be well, Adrian. Mr. Mark Royst, I believe. Is there any opportunity to use lighter rolling stock that costs less to operate? The other commenters have already spoken. Or I've read it aloud.
Thank you. Bringing it back to the committee for comments, Director Zamuda.
Well, as I had also mentioned on Monday, that I think the utilization of the lines of credit, as the agency has done, was really the best way to immediately be able to continue operating. We're now waiting for the federal government to pass the legislation that will provide some help to the public transportation systems, and hopefully we will get a share of that apple that will allow us to exist in that lower level of service reduction that will be coming up in the next week or two.
Director Chavez?
Thank you. And I want to thank the staff for the work. I know all these presentations take a lot of time, and it's a chaotic time to be doing work. So I really appreciate it. I know we all do. I'm curious about whether or not, if we were interviewing people who were on Caltrain and they were first responders or emergency, like nurses or any essential workers, which I imagine most of them are, as to whether or not we would be able to get a reimbursement from FEMA for the trainings, or at least some part of that.
Great question. We have, of course, historic survey data about the nature of our ridership. We've asked, actually, I think, Michelle, we've asked the conductors to just give us some sense, particularly of the weekend ridership, who's riding from their experience. They know a lot of the passengers. They know more about the passengers than might be obvious at times. That'll be something we'll look at. We're still parsing the text of the legislation. There is a possibility that some part of it could change before it gets through the process. My guess is the parts that change, if any, won't be in the transportation part of it. There's a couple other areas that there's some controversy about. We are studying all of the language as it is now and working with others to try to make sure that all of us are in a position to recoup as much as possible that could qualify for recoupment. But that's a great question.
It is a great question. Director Chavez, hi. I am having someone look at that issue, and I will get back to the board, because I think that is very creative, and we should look at every angle on federal funding. I don't think FEMA was addressed specifically in this new legislation we're talking about, that there was already language and there's already a program that governs FEMA. So we will look at what's available under that federal agency relief. And I am going to get off the video.
Okay, in style too. It kind of,
there you go.
That was like The Matrix or something. Great. Just real quick, I know that some of us have a hard stop, and so we're going to get out of here pretty quick. But I just wanted to note that, I'm. As the kids would say, low-key terrified right now. I don't know where this is headed in terms of ridership and how long it's going to take. And I hope we get frequent updates from staff. I'm very curious as to if we do need to, at some point, contemplate reducing service farther, whether or not SamTrans can play a role in providing kind of a bus bridge. I mean, as it happens, we run a route on El Camino that is the same route essentially as Caltrain runs for a large portion of the tracks. And essentially with no traffic, we could kind of experiment with BRT for the first time.
Something happened to you when you said that.
You just matrixed yourself.
Yeah, that same matrix effect again. That was great. Whoever's doing that's very interesting. Anyhow, thank you all, seriously, for your hard work on this and your creative thinking. Please keep us all in the loop as frequently as you can. Things are not going to turn around anytime soon, and it'll be interesting to see what happens when some sense of normality returns, and whether or not we still have the same number of folks who need to commute to work. And that's really grim and sad to contemplate. That's all I have. If there are no further comments from my colleagues, looking, seeing none, I believe that takes us to committee member requests. Any committee member requests?
Yeah.
Seeing none, that takes us to the date and time of our next regular WIP-LIP committee meeting, which will be April 22nd, 2020 at 3 p.m. probably virtually, but if something changes at the SamTrans or San Mateo County Transit District Administrative Building, second floor, 1250 San Carlos Avenue, San Carlos, or by Zoom. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, to you and your staff.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Be safe.
Thank you. Oh.